KALW.
I had this vision in the temple earlier, and I wrote up on the wall something that's my truth.
I'm just here to, like, keep our spirit going, but, like, acknowledge the loss that I've experienced. I'm gonna cry.
For me, the biggest part about Burning Man and the reason I come back is the temple.
When we were blessing the temple, the wind was blowing, but when we got to her, I mentioned her name, the wind kind of stopped.
The first time I ever walked into one, it changed my life. It's probably the one place at Burning Man that is what I consider sacred.
My wife and I wanted to go have a child, and it took us over 2.5 years to have a child. And it was really hard. And we would come here and make prayers in the temple.
Of course, we stand over a funeral plot for our son, and we cry, but we don't always feel him there. It feels empty. But here in this temple, it doesn't feel empty. It feels alive.
Welcome back to the intersection at Burning Man. Deep in the Black Rock Desert, way beyond the theme camps and the man that gives the event its name, there's another elaborate wooden structure. It blends art and architecture inside and out. And arguably, it's the sacred and spiritual center of Burning Man. Burners simply call it the temple. Grief is perhaps the most apparent emotion expressed and experienced here. That grief that comes with losing a loved one, and the more diffuse grief that can come with simply being alive on this planet at this moment. If we ever needed a place to grieve, it's now. A pandemic rages, much of the country is on fire, and we are finally confronting the injustices faced by Black Americans. Instead of communing in Black Rock City and contemplating at the temple, this year, we have to settle for digital approximations of both, at home and in private. But it begs the question, why do burners have such a strong attachment to a temporary structure that's little more than wood and nails? Reporter Jonathan Davis began searching for the answer last August in Oakland, California. That's where the 2019 temple was being constructed. He then followed it to the Nevada desert, where it was gifted to the temporary city of burners. This is the temple and Jonathan's journey.
I'm at American Steel. Looking for bay number 2, where Jordy is building the temple.
Over the last 20 years, a massive open-air wooden structure known as the temple has been built annually for Burning Man's Black Rock City. And while each of those temples may feel similar year to year, the temple is reimagined and redesigned by the artist who built it.
Okay, here we go, bay 2.
Artists from around the world submit their proposals, and only one is chosen. I'm here at American Steel to interview this year's winning artist.
Jordy, over there in the black t-shirt on the left.
Thank you.
Jordy Vanderbosch. Finding Jordy is not that easy. American Steel is huge. Big industrial art is made here. The kind of art you see at Burning Man. And there's people everywhere building different parts of the temple. Now realize, this isn't normal construction work. First of all, these are all volunteers. And second, building the temple is laden with a different kind of meaning and emotion.
I'm doing this all for my buddy John King, who died this year. He and his heart, he was a burner many years, and so every piece of wood I'm cutting for him, man. That brings me to tears.
Adam Schindelman goes by Sugar Bear on the playa. He's a large, muscular man using a table saw to cut pieces of wood. He, along with dozens of others, are on this year's Temple Crew, a team of volunteer artists and builders, both professional and amateur, each with a personal connection to the temple and a reason for building it. I've been to Burning Man in the past, so I'm aware of the range of feelings that people bring to the temple, including grief and loss. But in this moment with Sugar Bear, I'm having an emotional experience. I'm being reminded that I've stepped into working on this particular story during a challenging moment in my life. You see, my father seems to be declining. Over the last several months, my dad, Alan, has been experiencing some sort of physical weakening. His doctors aren't particularly worried. They think it's normal given he's in his 80s. And it's true, he does sound okay.
Hi guys, hope you had a good time, or having a good time. I'm in bed now, I'm going to go to sleep. Thank you for calling, adios. Talk to you later, goodbye.
Having always had an aging father, one who had me in his 50s, I've been extra attentive to his health. And right now, I do feel like something's off. So I've been questioning whether I should even go to the burn. What if I go and something bad happens while I'm gone? What if I could have been home to help? What if I can't get that phone call? I refocus and remember why I'm here. I walk through the long workspace and find the guy I'm looking for. It's Jordy, the designer. He's showing some fellow builders how to bundle cut wood.
It's a strap. It binds this stack of loose wood so it doesn't fall all over the road when we transport it.
Jordy and I head outside and sit at a picnic table. I ask him what sort of place he considers the temple.
I don't want to say sacred per se, but there's usually a different type of activity, a different feeling that happens in the temple. And I mean, if you want to drive your art car with a bunch of naked people, that's totally cool. It's just not done in the temple. The temple is reserved for more personal, maybe more quiet, a different kind of emotional experience.
Although Jordy is an architect, that's not a requirement to build a temple. He tells me about his minimalist design as compared to other temples.
I wanted the temple to kind of look like it belonged at the playa. It's an old place, and so I looked at older sacred spaces that have endured. This temple is a series of what I call torii gates, because I got inspiration from torii gates in Japan.
Torii gates are the big gateways you'd see in front of a Japanese Shinto shrine. A large structural horizontal block sits on top of two tall vertical supports, creating a gateway you'd walk under and through. And they symbolically mark the transition from the ordinary to the sacred.
Repetition creates power. There's 20 of these torii gates. The ones on the end are the same size, and in the middle, they start to grow. The torii is growing. That represents growth. And then you can say, as we get older, we kind of diminish. And so the temple then starts to get smaller again, and it ends the same way it begins. And then
altogether, they create a temple that's more than 200 feet long and 4.5 stories tall. At the center of those two tallest torii, there's an opening that lets in light. For Jordy, that represents the pivotal sort of moment that can lead to our life-changing course. And for all these reasons, he chose to name this temple the Temple of Direction. This is, of course, all theoretical. Here at American Steel, the temple is being pre-cut, and it will be shipped to the desert and actually built out there. The very first temple at Burning Man had a very different look and design process. It was built with wooden cutouts left over from a toy factory that made big dinosaur jigsaw puzzles. David Best was the first temple designer back in 2000, and he's built almost half of them since then. He finds design inspiration in both Eastern and Western traditions.
We're a Western culture, so we look at magazines and National Geographic, and we think of temples as being, you know, Angkor Wat or the cathedral in Notre Dame, you know, the Gothic churches. So it's like using a standard stereotype of a temple, pointed spire, ornate, various altar spaces. Over the years, there's been other temples down here. The Flaming Lotus Girls did a temple. And they went completely away from my direction of building a temple and made what looked like a rock or a hillside. Created controversy in terms of, well, that's not like a temple. But it opened up the door to other shapes for a temple.
These days, the temple costs about $300,000 to build. The Burning Man organization chips in $115,000 through their temple grant program, and it's up to the builder and team to fundraise the rest. In terms of selecting a temple, Burning Man looks for several things: visual impact, lots of entrances and exits, places for visitors to leave their offerings where they won't blow away, something that's non-denominational, something that's not too climbable, and something that's feasible. Once the crew arrives in the desert, the temple has to be built for Black Rock City in about 2 weeks. Things are beginning to wrap up at American Steel, and the crew will soon head out to the desert. I have a couple of weeks to get my own affairs in order before I head to Burning Man Build Week and the beginning of a very alternate reality. I'm now in the middle of the very hot and very dusty Black Rock Desert. I'm now at Burning Man. It's Thursday, 2 days before Gate, when the event officially begins, and 2 days before the temple is supposed to open. I arrive to the build site and head inside of the temple as construction is happening. I quickly run into Jordy.
I'm a little worn out.
With bloodshot eyes behind a very dusty face, Jordy looks a bit exhausted. I ask him if he's learned any lessons as a first-time temple builder.
Yeah, be willing to fire the right people. You don't have to be everybody's friend. Kind of harsh words, but there's just this idea of inclusion, but at a certain point, you just got to realize the inclusion is actually to a detriment of the project.
But according to Burning Man, inclusion is a part of the goal.
The people that volunteer to build the temple don't need to be the people that have the most skills. My name is Katie Hazard, and that is my real last name, and I'm the head of the art department at Burning Man. Obviously, you need good carpenters and a range of people like that, but you need to find a place for the woman whose son just committed suicide that needs to put this time into putting her heart and her body and her soul into working in community with other people. The goal isn't to have the temple open on Sunday morning and beautiful. That's one of the goals. But it's the process as much as the product that's important.
So there's some contentiousness. In fact, everywhere I turn during the making of this story, people are deeply upset with Jordy and frustrated with his approach to building the temple. Yes, Burning Man is not without conflict and ego. But the temple is an offering that is meant to go past all that. And the goal to have it open and ready for the community is that unifying vision. So, the building goes on. I bump into someone supervising the construction of the Tories. Her name is Soren Kim, and she's one of the build leads. I ask her how the temple build is moving along from her perspective.
We're doing really, really well right now. We built 20 Tories, and we've got 5 left to set. And they're getting bolted together and braced to be lifted. And we've got this VR here that's going to lift them up. And
what's a VR?
It's like a forklift on crack. Instead of just going up and down, it's got like an arm. And it can like reach up and out. They're actually looking like we might open on time this year.
Is that a rarity?
That's a rarity for Temple. Maybe Temple crew gets to go actually see Burning Man this year.
There's another group here, one that supports the transition from a build site to an open temple. That group is known as the Temple Guardians.
I'm Cherub, and I'm the leader of the Temple Guardians.
Steve Cabrera, aka Cherub, is one of 400 volunteers.
The temple is the place that the community has chosen to be that sacred place to mourn, to move through, to transition, to transform. And as guardians, our job is to ensure that that space is available.
He tells me that before the temple opens, there's an annual and somewhat new tradition where the tribe indigenous to these lands leads a temple blessing ceremony.
Having the temple blessed by the Paiutes, the local people, we're visitors to their land. And we have this party, we create this city, and we create this space that we call sacred in an area that is sacred to them.
I think until we bring our prayers and they're there, it's just there. It's just a object.
Dean Barlees is one of the spiritual elders of the Paiute tribe.
The blessing at the temple was for the land, just to keep things from causing disruption in the way we believe. Blessing for all the emotion that people bring to the temple. So we have to come and take care of the land, take care of the ancestors that are still here. We're still caretakers, no matter what anybody says, no matter what the laws say, we're still caretakers. That has not been taken away from us by Creator.
Often burners bring the ashes of loved ones to be left in the temple, but Dean and the Paiutes have requested those cremains not be left behind on the land.
We ask that remains not be brought. They can bring it to the temple and do a memorial, but they need to take it home and take care of it instead of way out here. We believe that because they're non-native, it makes it more difficult for us to keep it in harmony, keep balanced.
I asked Dean if he left anything in the temple this year.
One of my sisters passed away, and she loved coming out here. So I put her name there. I used our red paint, sacred paint, and made a four-direction symbol there, her name. And, you know, when we were blessing the temple, the wind was blowing, but when we got to her, I mentioned her name, the wind kind of stopped, slowed down. Then I knew she was going to be here until Burning Man's over, and then she'll go continue her journey.
It's now Sunday morning. The gates to Burning Man officially opened at midnight. Burners have been building for weeks and preparing for months, all for this one temporary week ahead of us. I head out on my beach cruiser and bike into the open desert, headed for the temple, uncertain if it's actually open yet. As I exit the city, I pass the Esplanade, the perimeter that marks the beginning of the city grid and home to some of the biggest and loudest camps at Burning Man. I keep riding and I can now see the speck of a temple out in the distance. I pass the man, who towers at 6 stories tall and will be burned down in a week. I bike deeper and deeper, passing all sorts of interesting and intricate art, but I stay focused on the distant structure rising from the dust. The massive line of torii, growing to a high peak at the center, creates a profile like the Golden Gate Bridge. I finally reach the temple. People are around. In fact, it appears the temple's been open for hours. I park my bike, take a deep breath, and walk in.
I'm at the temple right now. Already the walls are covered in the names of those who've been lost, and pictures and collages and poems, memorials to those who have passed, to those things that people are grieving. People are supporting others, helping them put up and place their art. It's very somber, very quiet. Bass rolls in the background from the city, but this place is something different.
Burners are transforming the space from a mere wooden building to something more. As visitors attach their memorials to the wooden torii with staple guns, others write their messages directly onto them with permanent markers. Some folks just quietly read and contemplate. I'm still at Burning Man, but the vibe inside here is as if I'm somewhere else entirely. And that's the thing that's making me wonder whether I should be somewhere else. Surrounded by all these tributes, I'm thinking a lot about Dad. I wonder how he's doing. I think of him and his voice and how we always joke around.
No, you're recording.
I turned it off.
I don't know that to be true.
Come look at it.
I don't know if it's off.
You didn't fucking turn it off. You're fucking lying.
No.
I know you're fucking lying.
What do you want to ask me?
I'm sad to feel like I might be losing him. I know I should spend some time in the temple acknowledging the loss I've been feeling. But I have some major trepidation just being in the temple. though I suppose I look like a burner wearing a denim vest and a tie-dye sarong. I'm also walking around with a big furry microphone and headphones in my ears. The sanctity of the temple is palpable, and the temple guardians keep their eyes on me, especially as they see me approach someone. She's a young woman with blonde hair, sitting in between two Tories, writing on a piece of paper. She notices me, and I introduce myself. Her name is Jamie Davies, and she's from Australia. I ask her why she came to the temple.
So, I'm here for mainly my grandma. She's like really sick at home at the moment. She's got a brain tumor, and I like haven't lost her, which I'm really happy about, but I have lost a part of her.
Jamie's writing her a letter to leave in the temple. I ask if she feels open to sharing it with me. She does.
There were so many things I wanted to say to you before I left, but I couldn't bring myself to say them. I wanted to tell you how much I'm going to miss you when you leave, and how there will always be an empty spot in my heart that nobody can ever replace. I wanted to tell you not to leave us, but I don't want you to be suffering. So if you decide to go, I wish you happiness and bliss and serenity wherever you go from here.
Jamie says her grandma would have loved the Playa.
I mean, she's never been to Burning Man, but she is like a burner. And she taught me everything that I believe in, which is what got me here. Like everything from just like having an open mind to like being generous to like loving everyone else. So I'm just here to like keep her spirit going, but like acknowledge the loss that I've experienced.
Jamie's story feels very resonant for me. As I walk around the temple, I find that many are here to recognize all sorts of personal losses, transitions, triumphs, and often they want to have their stories heard. There wasn't always a temple at Burning Man. Back in 1986, when the very first man was burned, the event was a tiny and nameless summer solstice gathering. 20 free-spirited friends came together on San Francisco's Baker Beach. They built an 8-foot-tall wooden man effigy and set it on fire. By 1990, the event had come to be known as Burning Man, and its growth had already forced it to move from Baker Beach to Nevada's Black Rock Desert. By 2000, the man stands 4 stories tall, and 25,000 people have come to watch it burn. This little underground event of art and anarchy has turned into a full-on, temporary, autonomous city. And as a city's hierarchy of needs evolves, so does its infrastructure.
In our community, we had porta-potties, and we had kitchens, and we had center camp, and we had a man, and we had the police and fire and safety. We didn't have a temple. And a temple serves a different purpose than a man.
David Best remembers needing a space for reflection. And out of that need, the temple emerged.
How the temple started is maybe 20 years ago. I can't remember the years or dates. I was working, getting ready to go to Burning Man. We were going to unceremoniously build something just out of scrap wood that I'd found at a toy factory. A kid I was working with, named Michael Heflin, was working with me one night. We were getting ready to go to the desert. He went out that night on his motorcycle and was killed going 140 miles an hour. We were like a week away from going to Burning Man. But at the cemetery, at the gravesite, Michael's friends said, you know, Michael would have wanted us to go to the desert. So when we went, it became obvious to these kids who were young that it's the first time they'd had death. And as we were working, it became clear that we were making a tribute to a friend.
David Best built this first temple with artist Jack Hay, Michael Heflin's friends, and a slew of random burners who just wandered up to help. Interestingly, David and Jack had named the structure they were to build Temple of Mind, well before Michael Heflin had died. After his death, they decided to make this yet-to-be-built and so-called temple a tribute to him. Even upon arriving to the desert, they had no idea what the Temple of Mind was actually going to look like, and no plan for it to have a reverential atmosphere. But by the end of the event, every part of this temple had been written on with messages, altars had been spontaneously constructed, and new rituals had been created. The temple returned the next year, and it kept returning, each time a new shape and design, each year becoming ever more embedded into the mythology of Burning Man.
When I build the temple, I'm the carpenter. I'm not the priest. So people come and put their own beliefs in it, you know. People that hate God come in and use it. People that love God come in and use it. People that mothers slit their wrists. People that lost their dog, you know. My place is not to judge what people bring or what they're looking for in the temple.
Like all the world's temples, the Burning Man Temple contains a multitude of experiences. But unlike traditional temples, this temple has the capacity to hold all sorts of belief systems and all sorts of activities all of the time. Weddings and breakup ceremonies, celebrations and grief rituals, sunrise meditations and sunset processions. The many expressions of reverence and ritual are here. Sometimes that expression is a sound bath meditation in the center of the temple. Sometimes that expression is one of love and justice.
I had this vision in the temple earlier, and I wrote up on the wall something that's my truth, where I said, I love black people.
Marlon Williams is a racial justice activist.
I love us for being strong, even though we shouldn't always have to be. I love us for being beautiful, even when the world tells us that we're not. I love us for being, for remaining. And then I said, thank you, ancestors.
Sometimes a space that's spiritual but not religious can be radically challenged by something like a Christian Eucharist.
This is the body of Christ broken for you. My hope is that with whatever you have brought to the playa, whatever you've brought to this temple space today, that you would be met and encountered by a life-giving presence of love. However you name God or your higher power or know God at all, pray that you are met with a great mystery that touches you exactly where you need to be.
And sometimes you're having your experience backdrop by a full-on orchestral performance by the Playa Pop Symphony in the middle of a dust storm. Still, one of the most common uses of the temple connects to its roots, when David Best and others built a structure to honor their friend and their grief. That's why Harry and Grace Swordlove are here. They read to me the memorial they've placed inside of the temple.
I wrote, my son, my boy, my heart, how much I love you, how very much I miss you, Mama.
His name was Michael, but on the playa he was magic. And he earned that name. Last year was his and his mom's first year here.
When you meet Michael, you immediately got to know him, because he was that type of person, warm and giving and loving and accepting and non-judgmental. He just loved people.
After he graduated last year, he decided he wanted to do more, learn more. So he went off to decide to live in a kibbutz in Israel for 6 months. On March 9th of this year, I'm at home and I get a call from my sister, my mom, who was in a assisted living dementia care unit, had passed away. And so as I'm on the phone with the funeral director, I get a beeping on the phone and I answer it, and it's the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv. And they told me that they had found my son. He was out camping with some friends from the kibbutz, and they were dancing all night long at the base of Mount Shlomo. And around 5 a.m., my son had a boundless energy, and he wanted to go see the sunrise. And the sunrise, as it comes up over the Jordan Mountains and onto the Red Sea, it's one of the most beautiful in the world. And everybody else was tired, and they were exhausted. My son, Magic, he He wanted to go. So he went off, and they were half asleep in their tents. The last thing they heard was he was far off in the distance as he screamed at the top of his lungs, "I love you!" And he was just shouting out, whether it was for the echoes, whether it was for his friends, whether it was to God, or it was all of the above. And that was the last time anybody saw him. 7 hours later, it took 7 hours later for search and rescue to find him. But, you know, we like to believe. That he did see that sunrise. We came in. We weren't sure if we could make it to the burn this year, but we knew we had to. And we came in, it was Wednesday, and we were delayed and complications. So by the time we got in, it was 5 a.m. And as we drove into the city, the sun was rising. It was a beautiful sunrise. We like to believe that it was their son welcoming us home.
It's been very difficult, but this was his favorite place in the world.
His favorite place in the world. He would have been coming home now. After the 6 months would have been over a couple weeks ago, and he would have been coming home to come to the burn with us.
Was it important to you to
bring him here?
Bring him here to the temple?
You have no idea.
No idea.
Very, very much so. For him, as well as for us. And it's part of our closure. It's part of our saying goodbye to our son. It's part of us showing him how much we love him.
Of course, we stand over a funeral plot for our son and we cry, but we don't always feel him there. Mm. It feels empty, like we're standing over a place we shouldn't be. But here in this temple, it doesn't feel empty. It feels alive. And our hope is that as we come here throughout the week, we'll feel him here. And this is a place where we can connect to him more so than some plot of ground and a tombstone that should have never been in the first place. I've been going to Burning Man for 5 years. I've never stayed for the temple burn. And everybody says, you can never stay for the temple burn. I used to say, I'll stay for the temple burn when I have a reason to stay for the temple burn. And now I've... Now I have a reason to stay for the temple burn.
The memorial that Harry and Grace leave for Magic will burn, and so will everything that's now a part of the temple. That's because at the very end of Burning Man, the day after the man is burned, there is one final ritual that brings Black Rock City to its conclusion. The temple is lit on fire, and we watch it burn to ash.
As you see in the temple burn, you have nearly 80,000 people gathered together in a circle, you know, with all of their attention focused on this one thing.
Leica Young is a death doula in training.
To me, that's one of the most powerful things about that experience, is being able to see all of those folks together, you know, with a shared intention, watching this thing come apart.
Yeah, it's an amazing space to sit there and just watch that temple begin to burn, and every single person kind of holds with bated breath.
That's Leica's campmate, Dee Morley. Dee is here at Burning Man to memorialize his very close friend, Tim, who died 2 weeks before Burning Man.
To me, after Tim's death, my job was to appropriately memorialize him. One was to do that here in our art community with his family. And then part of the promise I made there was to take their hopes and messages and dreams to the temple.
If the man, the wooden effigy of Burning Man, is its cosmic center, the temple is its heart and soul. The burning of the two structures highlights that stark difference. The burning of the man is fueled by cheer, joy, and wild celebration. The temple by closure and quiet renewal.
We watched it burn. It was beautiful to watch. I definitely watched the spot where we put Tim up and, you know, watched it go up into the sky. I think as it began to burn, I certainly felt a feeling of completeness with what my tasks were at the time.
One of my favorite quotes is, "We shape our buildings, thereafter our buildings shape us." And I think that the physical space of the temple every year creates a different environment for people to grieve in and a different kind of experience. The temple this year was kind of like a long hallway, but at night when it was lit up, it looked like two staircases that were moving towards the sky with this kind of open space in between them at the top, you know, leading into the heavens.
The idea that the temple arose as a need for those coming to Burning Man is true but incomplete. The bigger reality is that the temple came to be because it serves a real need in the actual lives of the people who enter it, beyond just Burning Man. Building and burning the temple as a radical grief ritual has actually moved beyond the desert. David Best and the temple crew have built structures around the world for communities stricken by grief. Like Derry, Ireland, where decades of pain and trauma from sectarian violence is still being healed. Or Parkland, Florida, where a 2018 mass shooting at a high school left 17 dead. In these places, the temple was built with the help of the community and burned in their presence. Back on that first day the temple opened on the playa, I wrote a note on its walls to my dad, a short prayer for ease and comfort. About 2 weeks after Burning Man, we found out that Dad had cancer. And about 2 months after that, during the making of this story, my father passed away, with me at his bedside. My note to him reminds me that the temple isn't anything but a structure. Its potency, however, is created by what's offered to it and the ceremony created around it. Burning Man is constantly creating rituals, both sacred and profane. The sacred kind perhaps exists in its oldest and most apparent form as the temple. While at times the temple at Burning Man is one of the most solemn places I've ever known, it isn't a sad place. Rather, it's a place quietly rooted in a deep praise and gratitude for life. And its power is that of release, a release that allows that expression of praise and gratitude to continue moving. A release that is realized through our collective role in the temple's birth, its life, and its burn.
Thanks for listening. We'll be releasing new episodes of The Intersection at Burning Man all week long. In the next one, we'll hear about the history of the land and the original inhabitants.
Do you know anything about the people who lived here before Burning Man?
Oof, dang, I can't go back that far. All I can say is they were pretty fucking nice for letting us borrow this.
This episode was lovingly and painstakingly reported and produced by Jonathan Davis, and it was edited by Ben Trefney and me. It was engineered by Gabe Graben with theme music from Eric Pearson. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to the Intersection podcast wherever you get your audio fix. And if you want to know more about the project or the podcast, head to theintersection.fm. Until next time, I'm David Boyer, and this is The Intersection.